Chuck Schumer comes for the filibuster, the anniversary of January 6th, and MTG and AOC do their thing. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, by Alexander Zan de Sanctis, and by the sage of authenticity woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsor this episode is Tommy John. More about them in due course. If for some reason you are not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Jim Garrity, we're recording on Tuesday morning here, a couple days. We got the anniversary of January 6th that some people are gearing up to celebrate as if it's the combination of the anniversary of September 11th and Pearl Harbor all wrapped into one. What do you make of it?
Rich, you're going to find me in a dyspeptic mood this morning.
I love dyspeptic Jim Garrity.
For a bunch of reasons, but one of them is recognizing that this, you know, the one-year anniversary is coming up, and that most of the discussions about it in the this week are going to be really annoying because I don't think this is necessarily representative of public opinion as a whole. I think most Americans are where I am, which is what happened on January 6th was a really terrible event. It was an outrage. It was a riot. It was the perpetrators who ransacked and tore through Capitol Hill and clashed with police. They can call themselves patriots. They can call themselves the new founding fathers and every other self-aggrandizing title they want. They're loyal to nothing but chaos, and that they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. They are being prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and the system is working. It was really, really, you know, terrible what they did, but I think when you call it an insurrection, you're kind of giving it a little bit more credit than it deserves. These people were smearing human feces on the walls of government. They were literally a couple of them were literally dressed like barbarians. I mean, ultimately, this was
How do you define insurrection?
I think an insurrection is a little more organized, a little more has an actual chance of taking over the government, has an actual chance of seizing governmental and state power and using it to its own ends. One of the things kind of baffling about it is these, you know, some of these folks wanted to kill Mike Pence, and those folks obviously should be spending a lot of time in jail. But what was the plan here, right? The idea is they would disrupt the vote, and then what? We just wouldn't have Congress would never certify the votes, and Trump would just stay in office, and we just wouldn't have an inauguration on January 20th. We would just say, to hell with the Constitution. There really wasn't any organized thinking here. It was basically, we're going to disrupt the vote, and then somehow magically Donald Trump will get to remain president or something like that. I think most of the people are stupid. I don't think most people had any comprehensive thinking a plan for how they were actually going to make keeping Donald Trump president stick. Nonetheless, it was really terrible. But the interesting thing is that no matter how critical you are of what happened on January 6th, on social media, people will just assume you're somehow defending it. And then, of course, lots of other folks on the other side are going to insist, no, this was our storming of the Bastille. This was a great, and they're political prisoners into jails. Oh my God. Did you know that it stinks to be in jail? Yes, these are the people who have been fighting us in criminal justice reform for the past decade or so. So I'm not looking forward to this week. I think it's really annoying. I'm glad the justice system is working. I'm glad that the vote to certify the Electoral College results was delayed but was not really stopped. But I think what we know here is that, you know, a lot of folks on the left see this as a chance to make Republicans look bad, and thus they want to turn it into a Mardi Gras of recrimination going on for at least 8 days, maybe 12, or maybe all year long.
So, Zan, a feature of the Trump era, or at least the first chapter of the Trump era, of which January 6th was the exclamation point, was being able to admit how bad things were that he did without going out of your mind at the same time. And this is an event that I think kind of falls in that category. It was terrible. I mean, it was a dreadful spectacle. It was a national embarrassment. It did mean that there was not a peaceful transfer of power for the first time in our history. And all that needs to be taken on and can't be evaded or explained away. On the other hand, kind of the rote description of it as an insurrection, which is just mandatory, and much of the media is annoying. I think annoying is the appropriate word. And then the more substantively, the idea that we almost lost our democracy that day is absurd, because further to Jim's point, so what were they going to do? Even if they had succeeded somehow in occupying the Capitol for weeks, you know, Congress would just meet someplace else and certify the electors, and we would move on. And of course, there was no chance they were going to occupy the Capitol more than a few hours once the Capitol Hill police and others got their act together.
Yeah, I think in some ways the riot and everything that followed has been almost the perfect encapsulation of all of the problems we dealt with Trump, whether that was his, you know, kind of most rabid supporters on one side who refused to ever admit that anything he ever did was wrong, or his most rabid detractors on the other side who went so far as to, you know, abandon things they previously thought were true because he began to support them, and down the list. And I think it kind of encapsulated all that, sort of gave an occasion for us to witness all of it one more time on his way out the door. We witnessed how he, you know, didn't really do anything outright, you know, on purpose or maliciously, I suppose, but he did a lot of really stupid things. He didn't say things that he should have said to stop it from happening or attempt to stop it from happening. He was focused on himself and, you know, making himself look like he had won, somehow figuring out a way to pull off a victory, even though it was very clear that he had lost, somehow trying to, you know, twist the Constitution around to make it seem as though he could say that he had won and claim that it had been stolen from him. It was all about him and glorifying him, which is what it always was, whether he was at his worst or at his best. The game was usually, how do I make Donald Trump look like the good guy? How do I make it sound like I never did anything wrong and I am the biggest winner there ever was? That's what he was doing on his way out the door, even as people were storming the Capitol. And at the same time, then in the fallout, we saw him continue to do that. And we saw his most rabid defenders pretend nothing bad had happened at all, that it was justified, that you know, the people being taken to account for what they had done were political prisoners. And then on the other side, even up to today, we've seen his detractors pretending like this is the worst thing. And in fact, outright saying that this is the worst thing that's happened in our country, I think, since its founding, right? Has anyone ever heard of the Civil War? I mean, people have lost their minds because of Trump, and they're continuing to do it. And I think a big part of it is because now that he's gone, they don't have Trump to talk about. And this is kind of the final salvo or the final thing they can cling to make everything about Trump, because it's far easier than talking about themselves, admitting what it is they want to do, admitting the many things that are wrong with their side. They just want to keep talking about Trump. And so I think that's why we're continuing to have to hear about what was admittedly a horrible event, but I don't think it's one that requires all the attention it's gotten in the subsequent year.
So Charlie, I don't think we actually talked about this at the time. The January 6th committee got its hands on these texts from Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, some others, to Mark Meadows, chief of staff, of course, at the end of the Trump administration, saying, look, you got to make the president stop. And it was clear then that they realized the import of what was happening, that they were completely outraged by it. And then since then, you know, a lot of folks have kind of snapped back or snapped into a different place, where they want to explain away or excuse what happened on January 6th.
We should have been outraged by it because it was outrageous. There is no way to excuse this. And all of the attempts have been self-serving and farcical. Trump, forget for a moment the events of January 6th, Trump tried to stage a coup. Trump entertained legal theories that nobody who loves the United States or its constitution should have entertained, even, in fact, if one thought they were plausible. It would not occur to a Ronald Reagan or a Dwight Eisenhower that if the vice president could unilaterally overturn the results of the election, that he should do so. It did occur to Trump. And Trump egged on his followers and his voters and others in the country. And some of those, not many, but some of those people listened, believed him, and acted on it. And they broke into the legislative body. And they not only tried, but succeeded temporarily in disrupting its business. And some of them wanted to find the vice president himself. Now, I understand and agree with those who say this wouldn't have worked. And I understand and agree with those who push back against the idea that the United States was 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, what you will, from losing its democracy. But there were still people, egged on by the president, who tried to interfere with the constitutional handover of power, and they should be condemned in the strongest possible terms. And I think angels on the head of a pin debates about the nature of coup or insurrection or what you will, after a while become futile. What they did was wrong. I am nevertheless nervous about the way in which this event is being used. And one doesn't need to downplay it in order to be so nervous. 9/11 was clearly one of the worst things that has happened in American, indeed in world history. You will never find me downplaying 9/11. You will never find me suggesting that it wasn't monumental, that it wasn't egregious, that it wasn't evil. You will find me criticizing some of the responses to it, some of the ways in which it was utilized politically, some of the laws that were passed, some of the changes to our way of life that were ushered in as a result of 9/11. And I don't think one needs to be an apologist for January 6th, which I am very clearly not, in order to have noticed that we have, a year on, reached the point at which certain players within the Democratic Party, some within the Republican Party, many within the press, are leveraging the events of January 6th and the behavior of former President Donald Trump to try to gain political power. Now, there are people who would institute security state measures as a result of this that I will obviously oppose as a classical liberal. But I think more sinister than that is the attempt to use January 6th to discredit all opposition to the Democratic Party and its agenda, to suggest that anyone who is not within the Democratic Party or on board with its agenda must be extirpated from the political scene, that anything such as, say, the filibuster that stands in the way of democratic ambitions must be abolished, and in some cases to suggest that the Democrats' agenda itself is synonymous with democracy. I have read pieces arguing that if the Build Back Better plan doesn't pass, that will in and of itself be an endorsement of January 6th and repudiation of those who oppose it. And this is what one always has to watch for in free countries, the hijacking of genuinely terrible events for illiberal ends. So I have no time whatsoever for those who defend what happened, who downplay what happened, who make absurd arguments. It's just a building. Well, so is the World Trade Center. What was done to it is what matters. I also am skeptical toward those who, I wouldn't say have overreacted, but who have proposed remedies that just so happened to line up with everything that they had wanted before it happened.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that a little bit more. We're going to get on Chuck Schumer and the push for the so-called voting rights bills. But Jim Garrity, what do you make of the January 6th committee? I must confess, I don't find this a very compelling storyline. I haven't followed the debate back and forth very closely or all these executive privilege fights. But where are you on that committee? You know, there are some folks, you know, the Liz Cheney's of the world that think it is the embodiment of the pursuit of truth and justice. And there are others who think it's a dastardly partisan scheme from Nancy Pelosi.
The first thought is that if Republicans are objecting to how the committee is doing its work, then they should have volunteered and said, hey, we want to have equal participation in this thing. Instead of saying, no, we don't trust you to run this, we're not participating at all. Well, that's how you end up with Pelosi picking Liz, picking Cheney and other anti-Trump lawmakers. You know, you want to have some say in how the game gets played, get in the game. Don't, you know, sit on the sidelines and pout and say you don't like this sort of thing. The second thing is that I prefer if the committee was doing its work kind of quietly and in the background, and we weren't getting leaks and we weren't getting spontaneous. I kind of want them to work something like the 9/11 Commission, which definitely had public hearings. It definitely had some fireworks and all kind of stuff. But I think if you're going to do any of these investigative commissions of a big bad event, that remains the best example we have so far. You notice everyone cites the 9/11 commission. No one ever talks about, say, the Iraq study group or any of these other bipartisan blue ribbon commissions that come and go and never really seem to have much of an impact. Come out with a big, complete narrative, talk to everybody, get as much information on the record as possible. And then when you're done, put out all the information in one big solid, you know, report with footnotes and verifiable transcripts and all of that. And then until they're done, I don't want to hear from them too much. And I don't really like the way the work has been done, but I'll wait until the final report comes in.
Zan, where are you on the January 6th committee?
I don't know. I mean, I think it was important to take it seriously, obviously, and I agree with everything that's been said about it being a horrific event. I've said that myself, I think, every time we've talked about it. But I think the way that it has operated has proven itself to be mostly kind of a political show for the other side to try and punish Republicans for what happened that day. And so while there might have been a good way of going about it, I don't think it has worked the best that it could have. And so I haven't taken much of what they've done very seriously as a result.
Charlie Cook, X question to you. January 6th will prove a powerful tool, political tool against the Republican Party, the way many Democrats imagine, or not?
No, it won't. In fact, I think that you could probably count the number of Americans who truly care about this on one hand. That doesn't mean that should be the case, but I think as a matter of political analysis, it is.
Jim Garrity.
I just want this week to end. I figure we'll get more of the same partisan wrangling. I'm not optimistic that we'll get, you know, a universal agreement on what actually happened that day.
Zan?
I don't think it will be, mainly because I don't think it's much of a mind changer, I suppose. Anybody who is, you know, the most outraged people or people who are still thinking about it a year later and think it actually was almost a successful coup are people who are always going to support the left. And I think while a lot of people in the middle and on the right know that it was a horrible thing, it's not really much of a political pawn, I suppose, or it won't have much effect.
So I'm going to say no, this is not a voting issue. It's not something that most people care about very much. And it's not going to affect the 2022 election. It might affect the 2024 election, depending on who the Republican nominee is. But I think Democrats are not going to be able to make the hay they think they're making on this. With that, let's pause and hear from our sponsor this episode, Tommy John Underwear. 2022 is the year you don't put up with nonsense, and that starts with your falling apart, scratchy, stained, old sweatpants. Get the upgrade you deserve and lounge like a champ with Tommy John. When you start the year wearing Tommy John, you're that much more comfortable, so you can do everything better. Tommy John's men's underwear has breathable, lightweight, moisture-wicking fabric with 4 times the stretch of competing brands, and you'll feel the same level of comfort layering their luxuriously soft loungewear right on top. Tommy John loungewear is so comfortable and good-looking, you can and will be wearing them everywhere. With over 17 million pairs sold, Tommy John doesn't have customers, they have fanatics. Indeed, after 13 years and tens of thousands of 5-star reviews, people call Tommy John, quote, the most comfortable boxer briefs ever. There's no downside. Buy one pair and you'll never want to wear any other underwear again. Plus, whatever you choose, from new underwear to loungewear, it's all backed by Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order right now at TommyJohn.com/editors. Go to TommyJohn.com/editors for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/editors. See the site for details, and please, please check it out. So Zan, we got Chuck Schumer, who released a letter yesterday about how absolutely imperative it is to move on the voting rights bills that Democrats have wanted for a very long time as a response to January 6th and subsequent events that Schumer portrays as a threat to our democracy. They want to pass a version of H.R. 1's been watered down a little bit in response to opposition from Joe Manchin to certain provisions, and also the John Lewis Act, which would reinstitute aspects of the Voting Rights Act that were struck down by the Supreme Court, and Schumer wants to eliminate or at least make an exception in the filibuster rule to be able to do this with 50 votes. What do you make of it?
Well, I think the whole thing is pretty obviously a sham, right? They're using, first of all, the January 6th to try and claim that you know, all these things that they already wanted are somehow now more necessary in the wake of what happened that day. Kind of like the January 6th commission, right? They're taking something horrible that happened, and their first instinct is to say, well, how can I make this politically useful to me, or how can I twist this around to somehow mandate the things I already wanted and would have wanted regardless of whether this ever happened, would have tried to push for. I think this is very cynical. I think they're doing it for many reasons, but one is to try and make it seem absurd that Republicans would oppose them, or as if to oppose them in trying to pass this, Republicans are somehow allying themselves or with what happened that day, or excusing what happened that day, as if, you know, these provisions they want are the only possible fair-minded response to what happened, the only way to protect our democracy after what happened. It's all very, I think, appallingly cynical. And then to threaten to nuke the filibuster if you don't get what you want, to my mind, I think this has happened a few times already from the Democrats. They've threatened to do this if they don't get what they want. They haven't yet done it. But they're trying to hold hostage one of the most important parts of how the Senate works and say, if we don't get what we want, we're just going to, you know, break the rules or change the rules so that we can get it by ourselves, which I think is also a separate problem, but also quite wrong.
So, Charlie, this is just another instance of the pretextual government we've seen over the last year, or attempts to legislate over the last year. So crime becomes a big issue. So Joe Biden gets out there and the White House says, you know what, this COVID relief bill that showered all this money on states and localities, it can be used to hire police. So it's an anti-crime bill. Inflation pops, becomes a major concern. The White House finally tunes into it, and they're like, guess what? Build Back Better is an anti-inflation program. Then you have H.R. 1. Which was first introduced, I believe, in 2019 as a response to the kind of so-called disenfranchisement that was happening in Georgia and supposedly illegitimately denied Stacey Abrams the governorship down there. All of a sudden now, H.R. 1 is a response to January 6th, even though Democrats favored it on January 5th and still favored all the exact same provisions on January 7th.
Chuck Schumer is not a long-term thinker. In fact, the Democratic Party writ large is susceptible to these sorts of bouts of hysteria, and apparently unwilling or unable to learn from their past mistakes. It is frankly remarkable to me that, having seen what happened after Harry Reid abolished the filibuster for judicial nominees in 2013, that being a conservative takeover of the Supreme Court, the Democrats haven't asked themselves whether it is a good idea to be countenancing weakening or destroying the filibuster a matter of months now before a midterm election in which every single election analyst agrees that Republicans are going to take at least one House of Congress. Before what could be, if political trends continue as they are, a period of Republican dominance for a while. As such, I think it is incumbent upon the cooler heads of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, and possibly others who are quieter about their reservations, to recognize that even on a practical basis, this is a bad idea. There is no such thing as a carve-out for the filibuster. Once you've done this, you have done it, and you have opened the door for it to be done in all circumstances. Democrats seem to believe, or are pretending that they believe, that there is a difference here, that this is more important, that voting rights are unique. They're not. Everyone in this country, Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, thinks that something is different or more important from everything else. Speech, guns, taxes, And if they are given the chance to carve out an exception, they will do so. There is no such thing as a meaningful or comprehensible or discrete too important clause in the Constitution. There's no too important clause that applies to executive power. There's no too important clause that militates against originalism on the Supreme Court. And there is no too important clause within the Senate rules. If the Democrats move ahead with this, they will be abolishing the filibuster. It will not be too long before the precedent is picked up by their own party in the short term and the other party in the long term. It is also worth saying that the idea, on the basis of the merits, that there is a crisis in American democracy, that we have entered a second period of Jim Crow, is false. It is nonsense. It is as untrue as Donald Trump's claims that the election was stolen. It is a hobby horse of political obsessives and younger Americans with Selma envy. We just saw an election in 2020 in which hundreds of millions of people voted. We just saw an election in 2021 in Virginia and another in New Jersey in which turnout records were beaten. The only changes that have been made here in the last few months are to limit some of the changes that were made in turn in 2020 as a result of coronavirus. The idea that there has been a widespread restriction of the franchise is simply wrong. What Democrats have done is cast in aspic the expansive changes that resulted from the imposition of the virus and set them as the new baseline and anything that restricts them or rolls them back to the status quo ante as being out of line. But that is silly. I think most people understand that it is silly. And I think that makes a mockery of the argument, even on the Democrats' own terms.
So, Jim, it's almost all the provisions in the bill that are passing are complete non sequiturs to anything that happened January 6th. There are, or in the whole post-election period, there are some exceptions. There are some measures that have been added in there saying you can't intimidate election workers and things like that. That might be worthy, but that's not the main thrust. And all of this, it's not responsive to any urgent national crisis. There's no reason that we need to impose automatic voter registration on all the country. There's no reason we need to impose same day voter registration on all the country. There's some states that might want to adopt and have adopted these measures, but there's no reason for the federal government to insist on them as a national standard for everyone. And per Chuck Schumer's short-sightedness, if you're actually to succeed in eliminating the filibuster to do this, as Kristen Sinema has pointed out and justifying her opposition to eliminating the filibuster to do this, it would just empower Republicans when they have unified control of Washington again, which they will perhaps as soon as January 2025, to reverse all of it and depose all the things that they like, all the voting measures they like on the entirety of the country. And this just isn't a good way to run a railroad.
Rich, let's consider the absurdity of we've just seen in 2020 an election where Joe Biden, the Democrat, won the presidency, where Democrats won control of the Senate just barely in that 50-50 tie with Kamala Harris breaking the votes. They kept their House majority. They lost some seats, but they kept it. And the reaction of Democrats to sweeping into control of all three parts of the government there is that clearly we can't rely on trust our election results and we have to have the federal government take over the administration of elections. They won. Right? They're basically, oh, the elections, these things are a mess. Ah, they're completely unreliable. Yeah. And so in order to do so, I, by the way, Zan was talking earlier about how upon seeing something terrible like January 6th, the first instinct of a whole bunch of Democrats is how can we get something we want out of this, right? How can this work for us? I was reminded of the quote from then White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, back in the early days of the Obama administration, words that pretty much became the slogan of that two-term presidency, never waste a crisis. Of course, after a couple months, after the stimulus and green shoots and the VA and the Iran deal and all these other things we heard from the administration, it really sounded like never solve a crisis. But nonetheless, never waste a crisis. Something bad happening is something good because it means you can get something you want. People notice after a while, when you start seeing crises as something good, when you start seeing a crisis or something really bad as a great opportunity to get something you want, people start to wonder, how committed are you to actually solving the crisis if you keep seeing these crises as something great for you to get something you wanted beforehand? What we are seeing on this latest thing of, oh, we're gonna get rid of the filibuster, but only for voting rights legislation. You know, it is exactly like a replay of what we saw with Harry Reid, where we're going to get rid of the filibuster, but only for judicial nominations, but we're going to keep them in place for Supreme Court nominations. Now, lo and behold, you know, once Republicans were in power and they wanted to get Gorsuch nominated, it looked like there was actually a Democratic filibuster might work. The Republicans said, you know what? We're not doing a filibuster for the Supreme Court nominations. We already got rid of it for every other kind of judge. We're getting rid of it for this one. And Democrats were just kind of sputtering, but how could you do that? Because you guys had established the precedent a few years earlier. They never learn. And lo and behold, by 2018, Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was on the Judiciary Committee, was saying, you know, she regrets that her party eliminated the filibuster for approving most judicial nominees. Ah, if only someone had warned them. Mark Warner made very similar comments. Ah, I wish we hadn't done this. And I believe both of them are on board, have switched again to supporting the elimination of the filibuster, but just for this kind of legislation. We'll keep it in place for all the other legislation. Until Republicans take back the Senate, which is a good chance it's going to happen after the 2022 midterms. And my guess is at that point, Senate Republicans are like, look, you guys got rid of it for the legislation you like. We're going to get rid of it for the legislation we like. And then the filibuster will be dead. And maybe this is like a gravitational pull. But every time you see these Democrats, even today, they're saying, you know, ah, you know, we got to get rid of the filibuster because, you know, what would Republicans do if the shoe was on the other foot? For a whole bunch of years, it was on the other foot. Mitch McConnell refused to get rid of the filibuster because Mitch McConnell can see around the corner. He can see the day when his party's in the minority. And he realizes something that's annoying him when he's in the majority is going to come in handy when it's the minority. And Chuck Schumer and the Democrats refuse to learn, no matter how many times this happens to him. I told you I was dyspeptic today.
Breakout of table pounding over the Senate rules. Wow, Jim, I appreciate the passion. Zan, so NR has endorsed some changes to the Electoral Count Act. Dan McLaughlin has been on this. Our friend and colleague Yuval Levin had a great New York Times column saying, look, this is the changes that Republicans and Democrats want to make to the voting system just undermines faith in the voting system because the other side doesn't trust it, but we should look at the Electoral Count Act. And it does seem as though there are some things that can be tightened up there. One, making it absolutely clear that this preposterous theory advanced by John Eastman and others on the Trump side that the vice president can kind of unilaterally decide which electors to accept and reject, that is wrong, and the vice president doesn't have that power. And making it clear also that once states have decided to choose their electors through democratic means and through having a popular election, they can't go back on that if the outcome isn't to their liking. These would seem fairly obvious things, but they were things that were at issue, at least among some people on the right after the last election, and might be contended by people on the left in a subsequent election.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. I don't think there's any reason not to do a couple things like this, just to totally solidify, like you said, the reality that this is not actually a proper interpretation of the Constitution, which seems pretty clear to most of us, I think. But, you know, the fact that this happened shows that a law like that would be useful, or a clarification like that would be useful going forward. You know, hopefully we would never get to the point of having something like this happen again, but why not take any measure we can to prevent it? And I think that's different from, and you know, it's acceptable, and it's different from what Democrats are doing, which is trying to get something they already wanted, right? It's not actually a response. The measures they're looking for are not in any way responsive to what happened. They're measures that they would have liked to see 10 years ago, probably, and things they would have been asking for regardless of what happened. And I think they're trying to take advantage of it rather than actually trying to respond to what happened and prevent it from happening again.
So Charlie, actually, let me go to Jim on the exit question first. Jim, Chuck Schumer will succeed in changing the Senate rules to try to pass these voting bills, yes or no?
I'm going to say no, because I don't think they've seen anything that's actually going to change the mind of Manchin and Sinema, but I don't have an enormous amount of confidence in that prediction.
Zan?
I don't think so.
Charlie?
I agree with Jim, right down to the not having an enormous amount of confidence in that prediction.
So I kind of wonder if there, you know, Schumer has some angle here that's not evident. Otherwise, this seems so self-evidently foolish and going to lead to frustration. But on the other hand, you know, I would have thought the same thing prior to the end of the year when he's like, we got to pass Build Back Better by the end of the year. And there was no reason to say that if he didn't think he had some actual path to passing it. He said it anyway. He didn't have an actual path to passing it, which Manchin underlined in that Fox News Sunday interview in December. So I'm going to say no. And I guess I'm going to say no. I'm going to be with Charlie and say no with some confidence. With that, let me pause and do a quick NR Plus plug. As you might already know, NR Plus is a digital subscription service at National Review. It is your way around our increasingly extensive metered paywall. Your way, if you sign up for NR Plus and log in, you got to log in to see basically none of the obnoxious, annoying ads that might be distracting you at the moment when you're trying to read your content. Is your way to plug in deeper to the NR community. You can be part of our private Facebook group. You can comment on blog posts and articles. You can be part of exclusive calls and events. I did one of these calls last week or the week before with Carl Rove. So it's a great deal all around. We all have all sorts of first time deals for you, and you should definitely check it out. This is an ever growing community. It's really important for us to support our journalism. So all sorts of reasons for you to sign up, and I hope you'll consider doing it today. So Charlie, we had AOC finally acting like a sensible person and heading to your neck of the woods last week. She heads down to Miami. She enjoys some of the fine dining there. She goes to a sushi place, sitting outside maskless, nothing wrong with that, with her boyfriend. There, someone spots them, takes a couple snaps, sends them to us. We publish an item, and of course, the Twitter dragging begins. And I think justifiably, because you know this obviously isn't the story of the century, but it's a time-honored norm in our politics that when your locality is experiencing some sort of crisis, and AOC, given where she is on COVID, should consider Omicron a crisis, and New Yorkers, like people all around the country, are completely desperate to get rapid tests or any testing at all, that you just can't hightail it someplace else. And when Ted Cruz did a version of this during the Texas blackout and ice storm, AOC was merciless in her criticism of him. And then also AOC has dunked on Florida repeatedly, portrayed it as some sort of hellscape because it's relatively free compared to the other states that have instituted COVID lockdowns. But when she was called out on this in true AOC fashion, of course, she didn't show any remorse or come close to apologizing or expressing regret. Instead, she snapped back at her critics, including with the argument that there is pent-up sexual frustration that accounts for the conservative criticism of her and of women and of LGBT plus people.
Yes, well, that being so, I ought to start with a confession and, in a sense, an apology to AOC. Every time I have criticized her in the past, it was just because I wanted to have sex with her. And funnily enough, this actually goes for every time I've criticized anyone who holds any of her views. I can remember being at Oxford and reading Karl Marx and thinking, I don't really agree with any of this, but acknowledging internally that was probably just because I wanted to have sex with Karl Marx. And if you go back through most of American history, actually, you'll find that pretty much all of the great debates that we've had in this country have been the product of sexual jealousy. I was astonished.
the Federalist debate.
Yeah, I was astonished recently to discover this, that the 1800 election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was mostly driven by Thomas Jefferson's unsubstantiated and unfulfilled desire to have sex with John Adams, which he thought about all the time. And it's only recently that we've learned this from his diaries. And Adams was the same. He used to write to Abigail and say, "All I want is a night with Thomas." Now, I mean, look, she's an idiot. She's a fool. She's a distraction. She's also full of it. The defenses of her are weak. The truth here is that there are only two options for her behavior. One, she's not actually that scared of environments such as Florida's, in which there are fewer lockdown restrictions than in New York. She sat outside in Miami without a mask on. So she can't be too worried about the rules that obtain in Florida. Or she thinks that she is capable of navigating the coronavirus pandemic, but that other people are not, which is a distinctly un-American way of looking at politics. It is not good enough for our elected representatives to think that different rules should apply to them because they're more capable of the people they govern. It's not how America works. It's not how America should work. On the question of her leaving New York, I can't remember if we did a podcast in us or not, but I was fairly sympathetic toward Ted Cruz as a federal legislator. Ted Cruz is not the governor of New York. He doesn't, of Texas, I should say. And he doesn't work for the power company either. Had the governor of New York left for Cancun during that crisis, that would have been one thing. Had the head of the Energy Commission or the power company done so, had the mayor of Houston done so, that would have been one thing. But Ted Cruz is a senator. He works in the federal government. This was not a federal question. There was nothing Ted Cruz could have done about it. And I had no real objection to what Ted Cruz did. But as you point out, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did. She described it as a dereliction of duty. So one cannot apply to her the same argument that I would have applied to Ted Cruz, because she doesn't believe it herself. Now, again, I don't know what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is supposed to do about what's happening in New York. As our listeners will know, I don't think there's much that governments can do beyond encouraging and providing for vaccination. But everything that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has ever said on this topic militates against her leaving during this surge, especially to go down to Florida, home of Omicron Death Santis, the Grim Reaper who runs around the state murdering old people. This was a great example of the extent to which people such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have abstracted out politics, don't believe that it applies to them, and it seems don't really believe anything that they say on Instagram.
So, Zan, one notable thing here is AOC clearly has kind of learned the rule, though. If you do kind of this kind of base social media politics the way she does, you can never apologize for anything. You can never express the slightest remorse or regret. It always has to be doubling down and attacking the other side. And obviously, Donald Trump, an exemplar of this kind of politics. But AOC, for all her criticisms of Trump, plays by the same rules.
Yeah, she doesn't. It's funny because I remember early on in her political career, a lot of people, I think, on the right began making that comparison, or sort of in our more anti-Trump square of the right, I suppose, saying she and Trump are basically the same politician. She's figured out exactly what makes Trump so attention grabbing and just does it in the opposite direction, whether it's on purpose or not. I tend to think it's all kind of a show to get attention. But yes, I think she's not very good at what she does. I think I don't particularly care whether she's in Florida or New York. I don't, as Charlie said, think there's much she could be doing in New York, but she seems to think there's something that national politicians ought to be doing, at least when it's, you know, convenient for her to be pointing that out of her political opponents. It's convenient for her to be attacking Florida when deaths are at a certain level, and she'd rather be using it as a political talking point against Republicans than actually showing concern for people who might be suffering from COVID. But she's also happy to show up in Florida and take a vacation, I guess, and eat with a mask off, which she would decry someone doing if it were her political opponent. She's just not very good at what she does, and she doesn't pivot very well, right? That's why her responses to being attacked are so silly. I think Charlie already put a pretty fine point on the problem here, but obviously the problem is not that people want to have sex with her. That's not why people are complaining about her. It's because she's silly. She's not a serious politician. She doesn't have any real ideas. She's really just kind of a social media activist who managed to make it into Congress.
Yeah, we have passed some sort of event horizon, though, when a politician can say that the reason for criticisms of him or her are that people are sexually attracted to them. I mean, it's just impossible to imagine any other prior juncture in our political history. So, Jim Garrity, I know you've been rolling your eyes, thumbing your
you can hear it from over there, huh? I sprained an optic nerve rolling my eyes so hard.
During this whole conversation, which we established in our pre-show conversation, you don't care about. So let's go to something else you don't care about, the Marjorie Taylor Greene Twitter suspension. So I'm just not a fan of these Twitter suspensions. I mean, they're completely arbitrary. She is an odious figure. I didn't follow her Twitter feed particularly closely. I'm sure there was all sorts of misleading information on it. But many of the strikes that led to her ban, I don't know whether you don't get just three strikes, apparently you get five or something until Twitter permanently suspends you. But it was things like saying that the vaccines aren't working because people can get the virus, which is true, and if there's any doubt about it, we all know that now. And it was expressing opposition to vaccine mandates, which is a perfectly respectable opinion. And it just goes to how these social media masters of the universe think that they know what the truth is when they're biased and misinformed themselves. So this is why you had, you know, people cracking down on the lab leak theory, which ends up being, you know, perhaps the best explanation for where this virus came from. But what do you make of it?
Dear listeners and Rich, you know, when I allocate some of the limited supply of my finite number of brain cells and neurons to what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said or what Marjorie Taylor Greene has said, when Rich says I have to because we're going to talk about it on The Editors, and that's it. Not only am I not lusting after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I try to think about her as little as possible, and I try to pay as little attention.
That's what you tell yourself, Jim. Yeah. That's fine.
I try to pay as little attention to the, you know, circus freak wing of Congress as much as I can, because there are real problems in this world that I prefer to write about and focus on and spend time about. And in the end, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and for that matter, Marjorie Taylor Greene, they've become part of the entertainment wing of their respective parties and their respective movements. You don't see them talking, introducing major pieces of legislation that have any chance of being enacted into law. They never put forth any really, you know, useful critical solutions. In the end, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is not all that different from, plays the same role effectively as Joy Reid or Kathy Griffin or, you know, Don Lemon when he's on a bender, or that guy from the Young Turks, or I guess you could throw in Eric Swalwell. There's no shortage of people on the left whose job is to go on television or on social media and say something provocative and crazy so that everyone says, oh my God, did you see what that crazy person said? And oh, by the way, we've got the same thing on the right with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Mike Lindell with his Venezuelan hacker free pillows and Jesse Waters. And you can even throw in somebody who doesn't necessarily fit on either side of the spectrum, like Jim Cramer, who all of a sudden is like, by golly, it's time to send the military door to door to get people vaccinated. These people are crazy and stupid, and they don't spend a single minute trying to think, oh, what I'm proposing, could that pass constitutional muster? Because they don't bother thinking about that kind of stuff. Now, it doesn't really matter when Jim Cramer says, hey, we need a 7 days in May military takeover to you know, force, you know, vaccines into every last man, woman, and child of the country. But it's a little more troubling when elected members and officials start to do this. Yeah, I'm not surprised that AOC is beginning, you know, now decided to go with the 1980s Pantene commercial defense of her critics. Don't hate me because I'm beautiful. Fine, we'll hate you because you're conceited. The overall, so do I, am I worried at all about Marjorie Taylor Greene getting suspended? Not really, in part because, as I said, I don't spend any more time thinking about Marjorie Taylor Greene than I have to. Yes, we've known that social media companies are arbitrary and capricious in how they suspend people. Of course, from the very beginning of this pandemic, they should have been more reticent about, you know, kicking people off for allegedly spreading out disinformation, because what we know about this virus has changed month by month as new variants come along. They don't call it a novel coronavirus because you were supposed to write a novel while you're in quarantine. They call it a novel coronavirus because it's new. And because it's new, we don't always know everything. Remember this? Turns out the 6 feet distance was entirely arbitrary. Turns out now you've got folks like Leanna Wen saying, ah, you know what? It turns out cloth masks aren't going to do much good against Omicron. It's just far too contagious. It spreads far too easily. Now you got to get the N95s or Z95s or whatever, you know, 95s are out there and stuff like that. It's utterly infuriating. It's utterly predictable. And yes, we have argued a million times over that the tech companies are arbitrary and capricious, and nothing has caused them to be any less arbitrary and capricious in how they choose to suspend people.
Zan, next question to you. Who will end up being more successful on her own terms, Marjorie Taylor Greene or AOC?
I think AOC will, mainly because she's like a touch or two less unhinged, I think. And she's also more, her version of being on the fringe is more within the mainstream of kind of the progressive part of her party, whereas I don't think Marjorie Taylor Greene's sort of brand of being a right winger is really as close to the mainstream or being an acceptable Republican on the other side.
Charlie Cook.
I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will, partly because she has this extraordinary ability to make everyone in the world want to have sex with her, which is really useful politically, but partly because she has an obvious path. She may well end up in the Senate, whereas I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is destined to stay as a member of the House at best.
Jim.
Rich, I was very tempted to say that after considerable thought and consideration, I am biologically incapable of having an opinion on the outcome of your vote. I have like one small exception to that. I do think that Chuck Schumer is making decisions as if he's afraid of a primary challenge. And I suspect that he's afraid of a primary challenge from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So because of her ability to affect the thinking and decision-making of the Senate Majority Leader, by that standard, AOC is more influential. And by that standard, she's the more achieving her goals more than Green is.
Yeah, I think it's close, but I guess I tip AOC as well. And it might end up being that it isn't Schumer that she goes after, but Kristen Gillibrand, who's proven to be a total non-entity in the Senate and has very little to recommend her as a senator and would be presumably vulnerable to a primary challenge in 2024.
I guess we can look forward to Kristen Gillibrand coming out as a lesbian then.
All right, well, let's hit a few other things before we go. Zan, you have been wandering yet again, this time to South Bend.
I did go to South Bend, and a friend of mine from college got married on New Year's Eve. So we drove out. It was quite a haphazard trip. We drove out all day Thursday. We were there on Friday, got to walk around campus. It was the first time we were back since we got married last May. So it was nice to see campus again, even though the weather was far worse than it had been on May 1st. Got to go to the wedding and then drove back all day Saturday with just a pit stop to watch the game. Ended up driving in some pretty brutal rain, but thankfully, yeah, a horrible game. I wish we hadn't stopped for it, but nevertheless, made it back in one piece. And it was a fun trip.
Yeah, I took some pleasure. I've come, as I may have mentioned before, just not to like Notre Dame because I always think they're overrated. But I was also kind of glad to see this because just in terms of whether the selection committee has gotten the playoff picks right, it's always kind of nice to see the number five go down. So you're not thinking, oh, okay, should Notre Dame have been in there instead of Cincinnati? And I don't really think Cincinnati should have been in there. But anyway, my condolences on that defeat. Regardless, Jim Garrity, you've been enjoying the big snow in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, longtime listeners to the podcast have probably heard me sound every bit as dyspeptic as I sound today about the local Authenticity Woods public schools that acts like metaphorical snowflakes when it comes to literal snowflakes. We will cancel schools if the dew point gets too low. So if you're going to have a cancellation of schools, people are going to go, the usual local news coverage of people rushing to their supermarkets to buy bread and milk and eggs, because I guess everybody makes French toast when it snows. But for whatever reason, people all decide to react and hyperreact. And today, heavily late into Sunday night, into Monday night, we actually had real snow. I think some said it was 10 inches, probably close to like 6-7 inches by around where I am. But like, that's real snow. I have no gripes about closing the schools on Monday. They're closed again today, which makes me sound like makes me suspect this is a backdoor Omicron closure. But basically, as I was shoveling yesterday, I'm like, you know what? If you're going to have winter weather, I want to have actual winter weather. I want to, give me some snow. Let me enjoy it. Make it a real winter, which seemed even more remarkable because I don't know how things were in your neck of the woods. But around here on Sunday afternoon, it was like 60 degrees. And everybody's walking around in near shorts or, no jacket and saying, oh, come on, there's no way it's going to snow. It was real snow. It was enjoyable. The first snow of the year is always lots of fun. And it's after that where you're like, I'm tired of this stuff. Why do I have to keep shoveling it?
Charlie, you went across the pond for the holidays.
I did. And it was the first time my parents got to see my kids, their grandkids, for 2.5 years. And the first time my kids got to see their cousins for 2.5 years as well, which was absolutely terrific. I think playing to type, my favorite parts were the afternoons we spent in the pub. But had we been all confined to one room, it would have been great, because coronavirus has, I know, gotten in the way of a lot of families, but no more so than families that are separated by an ocean.
So I cooked a fair amount over the holidays, and something that just really annoys me is the misleading and completely preposterous preparation times that come with recipes. There's this dish I love to make, garlicky black-eyed pea shrimp, and it's kind of a gumbo type dish, and it says it takes 40 minutes to prepare, and I've made this multiple times over the years, and it never takes less than like 3 hours or 2.5 hours. So I don't know how they come up with these preparation times. I guess they assume that you'd chop everything in advance, but even if you factor that in, it always takes much longer to cook. I don't know whether I always have the temperature a little bit wrong or what is it, but it's really annoying to see that it's supposed to take, a fraction of the time that it really takes to make such dishes. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Well, this one is not necessarily the biggest or hottest topic in the entire country, but it is the sort of thing where once it happens to you, you're like, oh, this is kind of annoying. We've all had, a lot of people have probably gotten a speeding ticket, right? And you're like, okay, annoying if it actually gets it. But you think, okay, am I getting this ticket because I genuinely was speeding and I genuinely am a risk and, the cop genuinely thought that I was a danger? Or is it just because they wanted to make revenue, it's getting towards the end of the month? Well, our Daniel Tenrero, posts this, Chicago drivers get speeding tickets every 11 seconds. Based on a study by the Illinois Policy Institute, which is absolutely stunning and points out that, you've got this relentless, as he says, constant surveillance of somebody rushing to get your kids to soccer practice. In the meantime, 55% of murders committed in Chicago went unsolved in 2020. Makes you wonder, it kind of makes you wonder why anyone's living in Chicago anymore at all.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece by Michael Brendan Doherty that went up last week, or post, I suppose, where he talks a bit about the Latin Mass and Pope Francis. And I think this is something always worth getting Michael's perspective on, especially if you're a Catholic listener concerned about these things.
Charlie. I like Kyle Smith's piece, Patton Oswalt Turns Rat Against Dave Chappelle. This is a perfect topic for Kyle because it's about entertainment and TV, which he writes about, but it's also a subject on which he can become indignant, which he very much does.
So my pick is a piece by Armin White from a couple days ago, our great Movie Reviewer or one of them, together with Kyle Smith and Ross Douthat, absolutely slamming this horrible movie, The Power of the Dog, which is boring. It is inscrutable. It's just an all-around terrible movie that has gotten great critical acclaim. And one of the great aspects of Armin White is he just doesn't care. He doesn't care what other people are saying, and just totally slams this movie justifiably. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. He makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Zan. Thanks to Tommy John. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors, and we'll see you next time.